Jesus put before them another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed that someone took and sowed in his field. It is the smallest of all the seeds, but when it is grown, it is the greatest of shrubs and becomes a tree, so that the birds of the air come and make nests in its branches. He told them another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like yeast that a woman took and mixed in with 3 measures of flour until it was all leavened. The kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field, which someone found and hid. Then in his joy, he goes and sells all that he has and buys that field. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant in search of fine pearls. On finding one pearl of great value, he went and sold all that he had and bought it. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a net that was thrown into the sea and caught fish of every kind. When it was full, they drew it ashore, sat down, and put the goods into the baskets, but threw out the bad. So it will be at the end of the age. The angels will come and separate the evil from the righteous, throw them into the furnace of fire where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Have you understood all of this? They answered, yes. And he said to them, therefore, every scribe who has been trained for the kingdom of heaven is like the master of a household who brings out his treasure, what is new and what is old. The gospel of the Lord. You may be seated. It is good to be with you this morning. I appreciate the invitation from Victoria. I've gotten to know Stanton a little bit through some dealings over at the school and all. I see two familiar faces down front who helped my daughter decide to go to SMU. But I must say, I should have checked the gospel text before I said yes. It's a little daunting to be invited to come preach and to have 5 parables listed to preach. So get comfortable. We have 5 sermons coming. No, actually, the first 2 parables, I don't know if you noticed, there's a gap in the readings. We go to verse 33 and then we skip down to verse 44. The first 2 readings have already been interpreted for you by Stanton's wonderful offertory. I don't know if you listened to that, but the way it grew, just like the text grows, was wonderful. So I'm going to consider those done and we'll move on. Now let's back up a little bit and let me just remind you what it was like to be a Christian in the first century when the Gospel of Matthew was written. It was no easy task. Remember, most of the Christians early in this period were still Jewish. And if you were a Jew who was a Christian, other Jews just couldn't believe that you believed in this Jesus guy. They would accuse you of selling out your faith and your traditions. They would claim that you were not any longer faithful in looking for the Messiah because you were following a false Messiah. Worse, you let Gentiles into your community. So if you were a Gentile who was a Christian, other Romans hanging around with you would see you hanging out with those Jews, those Messiah followers, and they would accuse you of basically of joining a cult. They would expect you at any minute to be hanging out at the airport with your tambourine, passing out little pamphlets on the 5 laws to be saved, selling carnations. It was hard to be a Christian in the first century. There was great risk. You would lose friends and acquaintances. You would lose business. You would lose family. It doesn't happen often this early on, but you could lose your life. It was tough to be a Christian. Now, maybe if you were one of these first century Christians, you had joined the church thinking that God would suddenly make everything good for you. Everything would go your way. Or maybe you thought Jesus would return any moment, so it's okay that things are a little bad because just tomorrow, it's all going to be better, right? Any moment, in those clouds, come surfing down Jesus. Just the next tick of the sundial, it's all going to be right. But it didn't happen that way. Things weren't okay. Things didn't become all rosy just because you were a Christian. Jesus didn't return all of a sudden. So the early Christians asked themselves,
Is this worth it?
Why in the world are we making these sacrifices? Why are we facing this danger? Why are we going through all these changes? I mean, you've sold off your old life to buy into this new, but the new is just as hard as the old, so is it really worth it? Well, here we are some 2,000 years later, and I don't know if you noticed, but Jesus still hasn't come back. I don't know if you've noticed that every morning I check, Al Roker says something like, I was waiting for the day, he says something like, a new warm front coming through Texas, of course that's always the case, and with it comes the Son of God. Haven't heard him say that yet. And frankly, it doesn't look like we Christians are doing that much better off than the rest of the population. There are plenty of Christians who are hungry. Plenty of Christians who struggle with finances and cancer and dysfunctional home life and depression and fear and prejudice, just like everyone else. The rain falls on the just and the unjust alike, says Matthew. But the problem isn't only that we're just like everyone else, even though we're Christians. No, the problem is that we Christians are overachievers. We add burdens to ourselves, burdens that are particular to our faith, that are not there just because you're an everyday human being. Small burdens, little burdens like, oh, getting up early enough to be at worship on 8:30 in the morning when you don't know who this guest preacher is, and you could have stayed in bed for another hour in air conditioning, not to get out and all this. Small burdens like reading scripture when everybody else is reading Harlequin romances. Small burdens like saying grace in a restaurant in public when people stare at you. They're not a big deal. But we do add some larger burdens to our lives, like we choose to be honest on our taxes when we could save hundreds, thousands of dollars if we didn't. Larger burdens like giving more to charity because we are told to. Larger burdens like voting on the basis of our faith stances as opposed to just what will serve our own purposes. Larger burdens like caring for the poor, the sick, the imprisoned. Larger burdens like loving our neighbor. Are you ready for that rest part? You remember it? As ourselves. That's kind of big. But we have even huger, if that's a word, burdens that we put on ourselves as Christians. Not only do we carry around the burden of loving our neighbors, we have to love our enemies. Huge burdens of daily taking up our cross and following Jesus Christ. Huge burdens of being peacemakers in this world, in the world where missiles are being developed all over. Huge burdens of putting as our highest loyalty, not ourselves, not our tribe, not our nation, not even our family, but our God. Huge burdens of trying to answer the call, as Matthew puts it, to be perfect as our Father in heaven is perfect. Boy, that is quite a heavy line in the Gospel of Matthew. John Wesley loved that line. It's part of our Methodist DNA. Striving daily to do the will of God in a way that is costly, risky. That is a heavy burden that not all humans must carry. I was teaching Sunday school one time at a church I was serving years ago, and discussion came up where one person asked, would you still be a Christian if someone could prove to you that there was no heaven or hell? And I was surprised to hear everyone in the room say no. And I said, really, not a one of you would be a Christian if that weren't true? And a woman said to me very clearly, she goes, this life is a test for the next. And if good people don't get into heaven and bad people go to hell, then where is God's justice? This is a hard life for a reason, she said. She knew, and those others knew, how burdensome it is to live the Christian life faithfully. You know. The reign of heaven is like a treasure hidden in a field. which someone found and hid. Then in his joy, he goes and sells all that he has and buys that field. The reign of heaven is like a merchant in search of fine pearls. On finding one pearl of great value, he went and sold all that he had and bought it. Matthew presents Jesus as, in chapter 13, of telling all these parables. He groups parables together in this discourse. He's down by the Sea of Galilee, talking to the crowds. But then after speaking in public, Jesus turns and talks only to his disciples. So in that first half of the reading, the mustard seed and the yeast, Jesus was talking to everybody. In these parables, Jesus is only talking to his disciples, only talking to the church. They're not for public consumption. They're for people who get up at 8:30 and go to worship at Cox Chapel. These people in the first century, these disciples, this early church, Matthew's church, they were experiencing God's reign, as we said, as a burden. Is it worth it? But the experience of discovering God's reign pictured in these two parables, they offer a new vision of it. They only make sense to people who are struggling in that way. If you've never questioned whether this is all worth it, these parables aren't for you. But if you've ever gotten up at 7:30 and thought, well, I could skip today, well, maybe this is for you. If you've ever been tempted to turn on the morals and ethics of the Christian faith, this is for you. Because the experience of discovering God's reign pictured in these parables only makes sense to those who struggle with the faith, insiders. Now, I don't know if you know this, but parables have often been misunderstood by the church. You may have heard them called earthly stories with a heavenly meaning. They're earthly stories with an earthly meaning. They are puzzles. They are meant to be unraveled. They are meant to make you question whether you understand what they mean. They raise questions more than they provide answers. By their very nature, parables are puzzles. The problem is, if you read them enough, you realize the puzzle isn't interpreting the parable. The puzzle is that the parable interprets you. And it raises questions about us. I mean, just think about these two parables that I just reread. Why in the world would a man who finds a treasure in a field sell everything to buy that field when he could have just taken the treasure in the first place? It doesn't make sense. Parables aren't supposed to make sense. They're supposed to be puzzles. Think about the second parable. A man who is a merchant of pearls. His business is buying and selling pearls. Goes looking for pearls and finds one of great value, the greatest value. He sells his entire inventory to buy this one pearl. That is the world's worst business plan ever. Being part of the reign of God doesn't make sense all the time by earthly standards. Why would a person give up the ease of life in order to take on all the risks and burdens of the Christian faith? It's a terrible life plan. There are smarter ways to spend our money, our time, our energy, our loyalties, smarter ways to commit our prayers, our presence, our gifts, our services. Well, you know how jokes can go on forever, but it's really just the punchline that matters. It's the same way with parables. A lot of people interpreting these parables have focused on the fact that the first person in the field sells it, finds it, and sells everything. But really, the punchline is, got the treasure. In the second parable, we can focus all we want on how silly it seems that he would sell everything to get the one pearl, but at the end, he's got that pearl in his pocket. That's the punchline. These parables remind those early disciples, those insiders, reminds the early church that they haven't made sacrifices at all. They may be seeing the world that way, but that's wrong. The parable unravels that experience and says, instead, in moving from their former life to the Christian life, they have traded up instead of given up something. We have traded up. Think about it. Loving our neighbors as ourselves, loving our enemies, taking up our crosses, giving to the poor, caring for the widow and the orphan, changing the world. These aren't the burdens of the Christian faith. These are the rewards. Other people are kept down by hatred and grudges. We are lifted above it. We pray for our persecutors. That is a liberating experience that not all people in the world have. To be able to be so free and trusting in this life, to give away our second coat so someone else might have one, to walk the second mile to serve someone's needs, that is a great gift we have been given in Jesus Christ. Other people are stuck having to put themselves first all the time. How heavy a yoke that must be. The Christian life, my friends, is not a test. It is not a test for which we receive a reward at the end. The Christian life is the reward. It is the gift. Living out the Christian life isn't a sacrifice to get into the reign of God. Living out the Christian life equals reign of God. Parables unravel us. But not just Jesus' parables. People have written parables in the mold of Jesus for many years since. There's one by Franz Kafka. Now, you probably remember Kafka by being forced to read that short story, Metamorphoses, when you were in junior high. I promise I'm not going to turn and start talking about cockroaches now. He has another parable called Before the Law. Before the Torah. It's very much the same parable as the parable of the treasure in the field and the parable of the great pearl. The problem is, you've heard those two parables so much that they don't really have much sting for you. Let's see about Kafka's. Kafka says that now, before the law, there's a doorkeeper on guard. And a man comes from the countryside. And he comes up to the doorkeeper and he asks him to please be let into the law. Let me in. And the doorkeeper says, can't let you in right now. The man thinks it over and he asks, he says, well, will I be allowed in later? It's possible, says the doorkeeper. I'm not sure, but not now for sure. Well, there's the doorkeeper standing at the door into the law, but the door is open. And so the man who came from the countryside sort of bends over and peeks in. He can see in to the law. The doorkeeper notices him peeking in and he says, so, you're thinking about it, aren't you? You're thinking about going in despite my resistance. You might get past me, but I warn you, at every turn in the hallway, at every door inside of the law, there's yet another doorkeeper stronger than I. The man from the country didn't expect all of this, since he assumed the law should be accessible to all people at all times. So he decides to wait and see if the doorkeeper will let him in later. Doorkeeper gives him a stool so he can sit off to the side. And he sits and he waits, and every so often he asks, now? Not now. Now? Not yet. He sits there for hours and hours, days and days, years and years, decades. Can I go in now? Not now. Until finally the man from the countryside is an old man. He's no longer able to sit on the stool. He is lying on his side. He knows he is close to death. And finally something dawns on him. And he calls the guard over and he says, everyone strives to reach the law, right? So how is it that for all these years, no one else has come to this door. And the guard says, oh, that's because this door is only meant for you. And now I go to close it. Ugh. That's an unraveling parable, to say the least. But I know it's the first time you heard it, so maybe you need to hear it again. Before the Christian life, there's a doorkeeper. A doorkeeper on guard. You come from Cox Chapel to this doorkeeper and ask to be let in. But the doorkeeper says, can't let you in right now. You can't, but later, maybe later. Maybe later you can get into the reign of God, but not now. You notice that the gate stands open, so you peer in. You see the reign of God in there. And the guard says, I notice you're thinking about trying to get by me. You might. But just so you know, there's another guard. There's risks, there's sacrifice, there's burdens all through, bigger and bigger. You stand there looking through the door and you think to yourself, is this worth it? Is it worth the risk, worth the struggle to get in? I wonder if the struggle is the treasure. I wonder if the struggle is the pearl. So you take a deep breath. Come on, you take a deep breath. You shift the weight on your feet. And Amen.